quartet on ceremonial occasions, carried a sword, and was in every respect, except his actual rank, was an officer. Now, that rank was abandoned later in my career. But when I refer to a warrant engineer, he was the most junior of the engineer officers on board the ship.
And who came below the warrant officer?
Immediately below was a chief engine room artificer. Then, under the chief engine room artificer, came all the artificers, who were divided into rates, numbered rates. Fifth class, acting fourth class, fourth class, third class, second class, and first class. To become a chief engine room artificer, you had to pass an extremely hard technical education exam. So chief engine room artificers were both selected by their experience and selected by their ability to pass an examination. So not all artificers became chief engine artificers, and it was quite possible to be in an ERA's mess where there were first class artificers never referred to by their rating. All artificers were artificers, nothing else, except chief artificers. You could find an artificer who was older than the chief engine room artificer in charge of the mess.
Charles Simpson, Reel 4. We were talking about the arrangement of the engineering department. Can you tell me about the stokers?
Yes. There were chief stokers who were chief petty officers of years and years of experience serving in the engine rooms, boiler rooms and auxiliary rooms of ships, some of whom would have had experience in many different kinds of ships, including those which were driven by coal-fired boilers. So I often used to hear stories from very elderly chief stokers about coaling ship. Now, after the chief stokers came the petty officers stokers, who had various departmental jobs, the most important of which were watching the level of water in the boilers when at sea, and of maintaining the oil fuel tanks in the ship. As you can imagine, oil fuel is as important, if not more so, in a ship than the petrol in a motor car. If you run out of petrol, you had it. If you run out of oil fuel in a ship in wartime, you've more than had it. The ship would be captured by the enemy.
Anyone else in the
engine? After the chief stokers came, after the petty officer's father, came leading stokers. Again, men of years of experience who were quite frequently in charge of stokers, some of whom were, like myself, when in the Royal Oak, serving in their very first ships as green about engine rooms and boilers as I was.
And below them?
Yes.
Was there anyone below them?
No, that completes our department.
You mentioned earlier on that the artificers were somewhat separate from the rest of the rating.
Yes.
Were they subject to inspections of any sort?
No. It's very difficult to convey the enormous difference which my entry as an apprentice eventually resulted in the ships. In that, artificers having the rank of chief petty officers were not subject to inspections or were not required to follow naval tradition for the more junior ratings. Whereas when I joined the ship as a leading seaman, I had to undergo all the routines and all the restrictions that that junior rank conveyed. For example, I had to undergo an inspection when leaving the ship, when going ashore for leave or on duty, whereas chief petty officers were not required to parade before the officer of the watch. When attending payment, I, as a leading rate, had to remove my cap, put it on the table, and receive my earnings on top of the cap. A chief petty officer, who could only be 6 months senior to me as an artificer, was not required to do that. And there were various other little rules and regulations applicable to those junior to a chief petty officer.
Could you give me some examples? Could you give me some examples?
Yes. Chief and petty officers were quite frequently allowed a longer leave ashore than the more junior rates. Chief and petty officers were able to attend the cinema performance in a ship at a different time to the more junior ratings. Then certain recreations like tombola. Tombola would frequently be held for chief and petty officers only. Tombola being the game that they call bingo. In those particular cases, as leading rates, we were associated more with the more junior rates than the most senior ones. Likewise, when going ashore and occupying a place in the so-called Liberty Boat, chief and petty officers would go into a boat carrying them ashore before leading rates and able seamen rates. So, for a few minutes, you'd be separated from your messmates.
During that first, during your time on that first ship, the Royal Oak, where did she visit?
Oh, many, many ships. She was on the Mediterranean station, and we had two main cruises. One of which was to the eastern Mediterranean, and one to the western. And each of these cruises were, from the military point of view, a meeting of the two fleets. For example, Mediterranean fleet met the so-called Atlantic fleet at Gibraltar. And in addition to naval exercises at sea, manoeuvring of big battleships in fleet formation and in battle state. In addition to that, there used to be great goings-on ashore. There would be inter-fleet football matches at which the respective fleet sailors would yell their head off in support of the Atlantic fleet or the Mediterranean fleet. Boxing matches. In Gibraltar, there used to be a really, really well-organized and elaborate concert at which officers and men appeared on the stage in an enormous variety of guises, playing musical instruments, singing, real singing, no pop stars in those days, and acting out performances of plays which somebody in the ship had written and produced. It was great. A race up Gibraltar Rock to the top was another great inter-fleet sport.
Did you participate in any of those things?
The great thing about gatherings at the other end of the Mediterranean was that the entire fleet, from the smallest warships to the biggest, used to assemble in one great harbour, usually an uninhabited harbour. And then, in addition to military exercises and ship manoeuvring exercises, they would hold a fleet regatta, and this was the prime sporting event of the year in the Mediterranean fleet, when the pulling boats from every kind of warship, from the smallest to the greatest, used to take part in enormously long pulling races. Now, this was regarded as a 2 days holiday.
And what were the pulling races? What did they involve?
Oh, there would be enormously long pulling races, a mile or more, for the bigger oar craft. There were some with six oars, some with five oars. That particular one is referred to as the captain's gig. And you had the peculiar situation in which there were three oars on one side and two oars the other side, to compensate for which the boat was shaped correctly. And then they had even smaller pulling boats. And for 2 days, the whole fleet was on holiday and was encouraged to be in holiday mood. The smallest number of men and officers on duty, and the rest, all with their eyes on the regatta, as they call it. And we would cheer our own ships and cheer when our own pulling boats came a miserable loss, which in the case of the Royal Oak and the London was never.
What was a pulling boat? Can you describe it? Can you describe a pulling boat? What did you use?
The pulling boats were both sailing boats and manned by oars. They were carried in davits each side of the ship, and their primary purpose, of course, was to become lifeboats. But much more than that, in the ship's company's estimation, they were pulling boats for recreation when there were more often used as sailing boats than actually pulling oars. But the great thing, of course, was when boats from ships of a like nature competed for silver trophies, which were presented at the very end in a great get-together on the fleet flagship. Officers had their own crews, and ratings of different types had crews which pooled not only to the honour of their ship, for the honour of the department they were representing. For example, the artificers had their own artificer crew and pulled against other artificers in other ships. But then it was not impossible, though it didn't happen very often, for a really good artificer oarsman to join in the crew from another part of the ship. Because after all, you could only get 5 artificers in the artificer's gig. Well, 6 counting the coxswain.
Did you row in?
Oh yes, I both rowed and acted as coxswain. Being small, I was favoured as a coxswain. The less weight you had to pull about when it's not pulling on an oar, the better. It used to be very exciting, from the admiral down to the lowest able ordinary seaman. Used to take intense interest in the practices, and lying at harbour in the early mornings, you would go on deck and see anything up to 10 or a dozen crews out practicing. And the crews used to resort to all kinds of tricks to prepare their boats for the racing. Different coxswains had different ideas how to present the bottom of their craft to the sea. They had all sorts of dodges, like rubbing raw eggs on the bottom of the boat before dropping it into the sea. Sandpapering the bottom to make it absolutely and utterly smooth. Some of these practices were illegal and were only carried out in the dark.
In addition to those gatherings of the fleet, what other recreational facilities or activities did you enjoy?
The really, really great thing was football, because every sailor, from the highest down to the lowest, could not only play football, he could describe it. And those actually not playing, and there used to be the fiercest competition to get into the ship's first 11, those who were not playing knew every move in the game. And a successful ship's team, depending on the size of the ship, would have half, three quarters of the ship's company go ashore with the team and cheer. So we had all manner of intership competitions divided principally into class of ship. So you would not expect the football team from a battleship to compete against the crew from a destroyer. But destroyer against destroyer, and they had intership competitions. And for example, the very best team selected from all manner of ships representing the Mediterranean fleet would meet a similar team gathered from all ships, 11 men representing the Atlantic fleet, would meet in a grand finale, and then there would be hundreds of spectators. It was exciting, it was invigorating, It was traditional, and everybody loved it.
When you were at sea, what did you do with your free time?
Well, my personal time was taken up by studying, because from the moment I stepped aboard my first ship, I was determined, if possible, to become an officer. The position of an officer, the authority he carried, the uniform he wore, the privileges he enjoyed, and the quarters he occupied all appealed to me. So, from my fifth class days to the time I became an officer, my great purpose in life, in naval life, was to become an officer. Now, this required a tremendous number of qualities demanded by the Royal Navy. First, you had to pass incredibly difficult examinations, paper examinations. You had to be watched, supervised, criticised, advised by your ship's officers, knowing that you were a candidate, a hopeful for promotion. Now, the great and wonderful part about the Royal Navy is that no matter how junior your rank, once the ship's officers, following the recommendations of your departmental officers, recognised you as a faint possibility for promotion to officer, began to take an incredible interest in your needed education, your encouragement of officer-like qualities, which were such things as good manners, good speech, a knowledge of English literature, amongst other things, an ability to talk in company. All these sort of things, known to be a requirement, should you ever have the luck and the skill and the qualities required to go from the lower deck to the wardroom, these would be looked for and, when found, encouraged. For example, when I first mentioned to my departmental officer that my ambition was to become an officer, he, knowing that I'd have to undertake hours and hours and hours of the most diligent study, both technical and educational, offered me the use of his cabin when he was not occupying it. So when we were in Malta and he went ashore to the home he had in Malta, I would occupy his cabin and have a quiet, peaceful, well-lit place in which to study quite on my own.
Was that on the Royal Oak?
Yes.
And you were on that ship in 1930 to 1931. You were on that ship from 1930 to 1931.
Yes, in my first ship. But I didn't actually mention my ambition till I went to my second ship. Having done the so-called auxiliary course, which acquainted me with the construction and maintenance requirements of all the small machinery, that then qualified me for advancement to acting fourth class. And as an acting fourth class, I was transferred to a cruiser, a totally different ship to the Royal Oak.
Before we move on to that, next year. Can I just ask you one or two questions about the Royal Oak? What was the role of the artificers when action stations were called?
To man all places of mechanical importance, to add to the watchkeepers, so a number of senior artificers would provide extra watchkeepers in the engine rooms. Less senior artificers would provide additional watchkeepers in the boiler rooms, and were spread about the engine room department. Some had positions in non-engineering departments where they would supervise firefighting teams. This being well before the age of what we now call damage control. But it was the then time equivalent of those organisations within a ship meant to
sorry, you were saying
to deal with damage.
How did you keep in contact with your family when you were first at sea?
I wrote every week. And when I arrived home on leave from a period away from home, I'd find a bunch of letters somewhere or other in the kitchen. And you can imagine how many letters, up one a week, for 3 years and 4 months. But it gave me the greatest pleasure, and my parents the greatest pleasure, to hear from me once a week.
Did you get any home leave during that first year?
No, none at all. When I arrived home, my young brothers, who were 3 and 4 when I left on this long foreign appointment, they were playing in the street, and I passed them by without recognising them.
And when did you get your first home leave?
Almost immediately. My father, whom...
When did you get your first home leave from the Mediterranean? What year was that?
Almost immediately the ship arrived. We were split into two watches for leave because, of course, maintenance and ship security still had to go on, even though you were lying alongside the jetty. And, of course, maintenance was a major problem because you'd had a long 8-day journey home, and maintenance in those days was by repair, not by replacement. So if a bit of machinery had failed in any way in performance, you had to strip it down and replace parts.
So you returned to Portsmouth on the Royal Oak, is that right?
I transferred to HMS London.
And came back to Portsmouth?
And came back to Portsmouth, yes.
And how long were you on HMS London? Sorry, I should say, how long you were in HMS London?
From January 1932 to January 1934, exactly 2 years.
And what type of ship was the HMS London?
Oh, she was a new type of cruiser that looked like a liner. It had 3 sloping funnels and a very, very high freeboard. The upper deck was considerably higher than any other class of warship. So to anybody who'd never seen one, when one of the so-called London class came into harbour, they could have been excused for thinking it was a liner rather than a warship. And it was so high that if there was any kind of wind blowing, it would sway from side to side. I've often stood at Sunday divisions in harbour and swayed to and fro. It was so high, the ship.
How long were you on HMS London?
2 years.
And what were the main differences between a cruiser and a battleship as far as your work was concerned?
Well, as you can imagine, each new class of ship had new designs of machinery of all kinds, both from the main engines to the smallest auxiliary machine. Because in the time which had elapsed between, for example, HMS Royal Oak and HMS London, a brand new ship, all types of machinery, from the design and maintenance of the main machinery to the smallest little refrigerating. So you literally had to start again. Each ship you joined required you to undertake a study, which was often an individual study, gained by experience whilst on watch, but to a large degree by wandering round the engineering department in your spare time, talking to other artificers, and much a matter of self-learning what type of machinery you were now required to deal with. There were no introductory courses. You transferred from one ship to another and you felt your way around the